has come to fruition for Australia. They have what they came for. It's the World Cup title.
Hello and welcome back to Season 4, Episode 4 of the Boundary Rider Podcast. We've got a massive show coming up for you today. We're going to be chatting all about Glenn Maxwell's triumphant return to the Australian Test side. Well, it looks like John Holland could be coming from the clouds. The BBL, are they going to sell it? Are they going to look to privatise it? Who knows? Uzi Khawaja is a fan of the idea. Poor Jamie Overton, so close to a Test century on debut, while the England women's Test team is back for a Test against South Africa that we can't wait for. As always, I am joined by the wonderful Nick Savage, who has just come off a gym session and is looking fantastic as always.
Thank you. Got a little haircut, so I'm sure that's why you're singing my praises. Lock, Origin 2 was last night. Can I have a 15-second rap from yourself? I didn't watch the game, unfortunately.
Inject the whinging Queenslanders into my veins. That is all you need to say. They were thoroughly outplayed. New South Wales were absolutely dominant. Clearly had a point to prove from game one. And yeah, they looked a far better team. Queensland just fell off completely in that second half.
Game 3 is in Queensland then in a few weeks. Is that right?
July 13, I believe. So yeah, up at Suncorp in front of 50,000 Queenslanders, which will be good to see.
Just after the Sri Lanka Test Series. Perfect. Perfect time.
Very true, very true. Well, speaking of Sri Lanka, we've got to chat all about the Australia-Sri Lanka series. Before we get into some test match chat, let's have a quick look at what happened in sort of the ODI series. Of course, Sri Lanka took it out 3-2. Australia winning the final game of the series in a what turned out to be quite a close affair, but it looked like it wasn't going to be for quite some time. What did you make of the series overall? It was a really interesting one where obviously spin played a really major factor. We saw Australia kind of have two games where they did well and really a couple of games where they probably should have won and they didn't. How do you assess that series?
I think it's pretty easy to just label that as a lost series because of the injury woes. Obviously, we've spoken about it before, but the list of names that they missed out on was pretty telling. Steve Smith, Stoinis, Agar, Zampa, Mitchell Stark. I mean, they're five first-choice players right there. And it did remind me a bit of 12 months ago when Australia was touring the West Indies and Bangladesh basically a second-tier side. And while it wasn't to that same extent, it was pretty clear that Australia struggled with the likes of Kuhneman, Cameron Green, obviously strong cricketers, but don't have that international white ball experience. And is it too simple, though, to say, oh, there were injury concerns, it's not too much of a problem, or is it something Australia really need to look at 12 months or 18 months out of a World Cup, which will also be in the subcontinent?
I think it's really interesting. After that final ODI, one of the questions I kind of put to Aaron Finch was how he felt that this prepared the team going into the Indian World Cup next year. And he kind of was pretty confident in saying that they're not going to spin anywhere near as much as those ODIs did. And I think that's probably a fair assessment. But I think the players who handled the conditions well definitely stood out. I mean, I thought Alex Carey, I'm sure you probably agree with me, was pretty impressive this series, especially that last ODI chase. Oh, good. Alex Carey and Series apparently get Siri coming up on my laptop, which is absolutely fantastic. I do not need you right now. Siri, thank you. Goodbye. But yeah, Alex Carey, I thought was impressive. Showed good composure, but also didn't get bogged down against the spin, which I think is something that quite a few of the Australian players across the series kind of found themselves doing. Obviously, the big one was kind of Cam Green when he went at 50 in that was the fourth ODI that Australia lost. And just kind of struggled to rotate the strike. And we saw him learn from that in the fifth ODI, which I think was a really good sign. So, yeah, it's disappointing. I think Australia should have won that series. They still had the team and they still had the performances, especially with the ball, to win that series. I just think that hopefully they see some signs where they can go, okay, we can take some lessons out of that on how we play these conditions better. And like you said, a few inexperienced players who will be better for the run.
Oh, that side would have looked so different with Agar and Zampa. I mean, they've just dominated white ball cricket over the past couple of years. They've been phenomenal. And without them, it was pretty telling. I mean, Kuhneman, he didn't bowl badly, not by any means. I was quite impressed by what he had to offer. But as I said before, the lack of experience showed. But, you know, hopefully the Aussies take plenty out of that. I mean, I think they do have at least one or two more one-day tours of the subcontinent before the World Cup next year. So they'll be able to sort of regroup and learn a few more things about how to tackle spin bowlers on those pitches before, I think it's October, November next year, a huge World Cup in India.
Yeah, I just want to give a special shout out to the young 19-year-old spinner, Welalage, for Sri Lanka. He was fantastic. Finished the ODI series as the highest wicket taker with 9 for the series. It was 9 at an average of 22, I think it was. And this was his first ever series in ODI cricket. He played all 5 matches and looked seriously impressive. Again, another one there that Sri Lanka can look forward to seeing well into the future. You got to hand it to Sri Lanka. They knew the conditions. They played them to their own strengths, which was good to see. But it will be a little bit different when it comes to the test matches. Obviously, Australia has got a great test record. We saw that they were kind of willing to adapt to the conditions in Pakistan. And it will be a little bit different down in Gaul, I think, for this Australian team, that they're going to face spinning conditions that they didn't necessarily face against Pakistan. And already we've heard some really interesting selection things. We've heard some funny things. And before we get onto the Glenn Maxwell stuff, we've obviously seen a report in The Age today from Dan Breddick, who has said that John Holland is firming to be included as the second spinner in the test match, the first test match at the very least, with Ashton Agar's sides train set to rule him out of contention for this first game at the very least. And the Australians opting to prefer, I guess, the finger spin over the wrist spin. So I just want to get your immediate reaction to that, because it's only happened in the last sort of hour or so that report's come out.
Yeah, John Holland obviously has test experience, which is what puts him ahead of the likes of Matt Kuhneman. But I think we're biased a bit, Locke, because we both love Mitchell Swepson and we both love what he has to offer. And he's done such fantastic work in the Sheffield Shield for Queensland over the past couple of years. But I do understand that finger spin is probably the stronger choice on these pitches. We saw it 6 years ago. Obviously, Herath obliterated the Aussies in that 3-test series, a whitewash. And is it too simple to say, well, if Aussies pick a left-arm finger spinner as well, it could work. But even then, I don't know about you, I'd go Matt Kuhneman. He was really impressive in the Sheffield Shield this previous summer. He was one of the highest wicket-takers for spinners in the Shield for sure. And he's a bit younger. He's obviously done a bit more white ball cricket this tour. And picking John Holland ahead of him just seems a bit baffling to me.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's John Holland's a player who we know what we're going to get with John Holland. We know that he's a consistent performer. We know that he's someone who will land the ball on a dime, can give you that reliability. But when you've got a squad there, when you brought in 3 or 4 spinners around the squad, you've got Kuhneman there, you've got Todd Murphy there, and I don't believe Tanvi Sanger stayed with the squad, but especially when it's more than likely, if he's fit for the second test, Ashton Agar would probably come back into the test side. I think there's no doubt that if you're going Lions, your number one spinner, Swepson and Agar are probably your 2 and 3, can move that order around depending on where they're playing. That it makes sense to me to give Kuhneman a go, and then if it goes well, great. You've blooded a new spinner into test cricket to give him that opportunity to maybe play more test cricket down the line. If it doesn't work out, fine. Ashton Agar comes back in the next test. Whereas John Holland, you do know what you're going to get from him. He's been tried. He's rarely been able to cement his place in this Australian test team. And that's obviously because Nathan Lyon's done so well, but also because there's been other bowlers who kind of jumped ahead of him. And it just feels like we're looking back and I don't think it's anything about Victorian bias or anything with Andrew McDonald, as I've seen a couple of rogue Twitter accounts post in response to the story. But I just think, yeah, it's a safe option. And I don't think safe selections win you test cricket in Sri Lanka.
No, very true. A part of me sort of reflects on Stephen O'Keefe 5 years ago, a very similar bowling style to John Holland, a slightly round arm, they're a little bit shorter, flatter, faster. They didn't rely on a lot of loop. They just let the natural variation of the pitch, in Steve O'Keefe's case, in Pune, do the job. So look, we'll have to wait and see. It's easy for us to say, oh, it should be this, it should be that. But it's not until we actually see that pitch and how it performs on day one that we'll have a better understanding of who the right choice is. But look, I think we both agree Kuhneman's who we would have gone for. But, you know, McDonald, he's a smart coach. He knows what he's doing. If that is what's going to happen on day one, well, all the best to John Holland. Aussie fans will back him and no doubt he'll do a job.
We've danced around it. We've got to talk about it. The massive news that dropped over the weekend, that while you were asleep over in NZ, you woke up with a massive amount of messages on your phone, I would have imagined.
Glenn Maxwell is back in the Australian Test team. It's huge. It's a time we didn't think might come again. It's clearly a time he didn't think would come again because he didn't pack his bag of green with him, and it was sitting deteriorating in the bag in a cupboard somewhere. So he needed a new one for this if he does play this Test match. But what do you think of the selection, and does he play?
Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? Because if he is to come into the side, it's for Travis Head. Obviously, very similar style of batter, quite aggressive, as we saw Travis Head do throughout the Ashes. But also, Glenn Maxwell provides that spin bowling option, which, as we know, needless to say, is crucial. But what I loved was our good friend Barrett, who's over in Sri Lanka at the moment, posting a video of Glenn Maxwell bowling some off spin in the nets. And he quite rightly pointed out that that was probably the first time he bowled with a red ball in 2.5 years since 2019. Maxwell's last test was before the 17-18 Ashes series, before which he was dropped for Sean Marsh. And importantly, Maxwell, I think all his test matches have been in the subcontinent. He has a test century in Asia, unlike most of the Australian players in this squad. And also importantly, he could change a game in 2 hours, even 1 hour. He has that ability to, as we've seen Johnny Bairstow do over in England, he can change a match very, very quickly. We know he's capable of that. So, look, Khawaja was given another chance late in his career, and that's paid dividends massively. And we don't want Travis Head to have injuries. Like, obviously, we've seen footage of him jogging around in goal at the moment. So, fingers crossed he can play, but there's certainly something very exciting about Maxwell coming back.
Well, what we've seen is that if you come into the side for an injured or COVID affected Travis Head, that you tend to keep your spot for a little bit. Obviously, Khawaja came in during the Ashes tests, and he's kind of solidified his position as opener. If Glenn Maxwell could come in for Travis Head, it poses a really interesting question about how that Australian middle order looks going forward, even when they're out of the subcontinent. So let's go through what we think our team would be for this first test in goal, Nick, at the moment. I dare say our top four is going to be the same, that we've got Warner, Khawaja, Labuschagne, Smith. We're pretty confident there. And I think Smith looks like he's going to be fit for the first test.
Yep, there's no debate there. That's a very strong top four. That's one of the strongest top fours in this Australian side in a while.
And then going on from that, assuming Travis Head is not fit for the first test, are you going Green at 5 and then Maxwell at 6?
Yeah, I think that can fluctuate depending on the match situation. Mm. If you need quick runs, you can elevate Maxwell to 5. And obviously, they play very different styles of batting. So, yeah, 5, 6. And I feel like even depending on what might be happening, Alex Carey might go up. Like, having that left-hander up at number 5, depending on the conditions and the bowlers. So that 5 to 7 can fluctuate, but yeah, Maxwell, Green, and Carey in those spots for sure.
Yeah, and we saw how well Carey played spin in this series with the white ball. Okay, the bowling lineup. We've got four spots there then that you've got Labuschagne, you've got Maxwell, you've got Green, who can all bowl a few overs. So clearly we can kind of be a bit flexible here with the bowlers. Who are you picking as your four?
Well, I think just because of how well they performed over in Pakistan, you have to obviously go Cummins and Stark as the pace duo. Stark's finger, it remains a problem. I think I'm not sure if he's going to be eligible for that first test match, but if not, then Hazelwood slots in beautifully. And for the two spinners, if I'm picking them, I would be going Lyon, and because Agar is unavailable, Kuhneman. As much as I'd love Swepson to be there, he's a fantastic leg spinner. I do have a gut feeling that finger spin is the way to succeed in goal, and that's what all the numbers have shown, that's what we've seen in 2016, and I doubt that's going to change too much. So sorry, Swepper, we love you to bits, but this is probably one for the finger spinners.
And it's one of those things that you've got to pick a team for the conditions, you can't pick a team for sentiment, and I think I'm sure Swepson gets that, but it does feel a shame after he's waited so long for that opportunity. Well, this makes a really boring podcast because I've got the exact same team as you. So that's absolutely fantastic. But yeah, I just think it's the right team to get that balance. You've got, if you find leg spins working, I think Labuschagne is a very serviceable leg spin bowler. We've kind of seen that throughout his career that, sure, he'll drop a few short, he'll throw a few full tosses in there. But when he lands them, they're just as good as a lot of leagues around the world. So that's fine if you see wrist spin is having a bit of an impact. But if you've got Lyon there, he's going to be bowling. If we're talking of big innings, he's going to be bowling 40, 45, 50 overs, no dramas. Kuderman can throw in another 20 to 25. And then obviously you've got Glenn Maxwell as well, who can chip in there with some handy off-spin as well and kind of get a few to dart through. So, yeah, I'm okay with that team. We're waiting to hear what Andrew McDonald says this afternoon. He'll be doing a press conference, I think, about 5:30 on Monday. And then Pat Cummins will probably, as he loves to do, announce his team 24 hours out on Tuesday, tomorrow, as we're recording this. So, yeah, can't wait to see what happens there, whether Judd Holland makes his miraculous return from the clouds. We have to wait and see. Nick, before we leave Sri Lanka, we have to talk about this Australia A run chase that they produced in the second four-day game over there. It was quite remarkable. They looked gone for all money. They were struggling to really hold on to the game. And then Henry Hunt, Jimmy Pearson produced some miraculous centuries. Aaron Hardy produces, I think, 70, 80 of the best runs. And they get home in a canter. They hit, I think they spent about 70 overs hitting it four and over.
Oh, 100%. Like, chasing a target like 360 in any game is difficult. But on those spinning wickets in Sri Lanka, it was really, really impressive from, as you said, Hunt and Pearson. At one stage, Australia A were 4 for 69. They were in dire straits, chasing another 300 runs with six wickets in hand. But, look, they were superb. Admittedly, there wasn't a live stream, so we couldn't see as much of that match as we would have liked to. But Aaron Hardy, he's impressing me more and more. I mean, obviously we've got Cameron Green as a fantastic test player, but my goodness, Aaron Hardy, if he has another Shield season, there has to be discussion about him for international duties, because he's just been phenomenal. Another 70-odd from him. I think he's averaging 40-odd with the bat and averaging 22 with the ball in first-class cricket. So one to keep an eye out for this upcoming Shield season, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And just those numbers. So Josh Philippe fell in the 24th over. Australia were 4 for 69. From the next 72 overs, Australia scored 1 for 301 at 4.18 and over. Really remarkable that they were able to do that so consistently and get a win in that match. Yeah, fantastic to see. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Then we're going to come back and look at the England-New Zealand series and a bit of BBL chat. Nick Headingley has produced another cracker of a test match. It looks like it's going to be a clear result. Obviously, we're recording after day four, so England are needing 113 runs with eight wickets in hand. Joe Root, Ollie Pope looking quite set at the crease. But it's been a bit of an interesting test match. A lot has happened, but it looks like England will kind of get there in a canter now.
Yeah, a lot of storylines coming out of this test match. One that stood out for me, before we get to Johnny Bairstow, the great Johnny Bairstow, Jack Leach taking his a 10-wicket haul, his first at home, at Headingley. So after the most famous one-on-one in history, he's now taken a 10-wicket haul, including the bizarre dismissal in the first innings when both batters from each end middled it and it was caught at mid-on. If you haven't seen the video of that, check it out on Twitter. It's absolutely bizarre. But no, Johnny Bairstow, just very quickly on him. In that first innings, Trent Bolt had obliterated the top order. England were looking in dire straits at 6 for 55, I believe. But then Bazball came into action and Johnny Bairstow went on the counter-attack very, very quickly, bringing up another century at less than a run a ball in back-to-back innings. He's only the third cricketer to do that in Test cricket. Remarkable feat, and he has just been in astonishing form this year. His fourth century of the year. And I'm running out of ways to praise this guy. I'm absolutely loving this resurgence of Johnny Bairstow, because during that Ashes series, at least in the first half of the Ashes series, he was looking like the shadow of a great cricketer. He was not himself at all, as many of the England players did. But since that Sydney Test match where he got that century in the second innings, he's been, well, I think one of the highest run scorers in world cricket.
It has been quite a remarkable resurgence. I think that's a fantastic word for it. But especially considering the position England were in, Trent Bolt had ripped through the top order. It was a remarkable spell of bowling from Trent Bolt in that first innings. I mean, what were England? England were 6 for 55. Yeah, when Ben Fokes was dismissed. And the first three were all bolt thunderbolts that took out the stumps. It was the movement he got on that new ball. Look, I'm going to not include Ollie Pope in that because it was just a shocking shot. But I thought the Zach Crawley one in particular just was such a beautiful piece of swing bowling. It was really... I put this in a tweet and I didn't know how to word it because I don't think Trent Bolt is underrated. I think he's genuinely one of the best bowlers in the world right now and everyone agrees with that and I don't think that's a controversial topic. But it just feels like we don't talk about him enough, about how good he's been and how consistent he's been at this level.
I feel like we don't talk about the New Zealand team enough. Southee, Bolt, Wagner, the three of them, this is probably the best pace trio in world cricket in the past 5 years, with the exception of maybe Australia. But they've been phenomenal. And we just don't seem to, even when they won the World Test Championship, it was almost a surprise, even though they're such a fantastic team. It was, oh, New Zealand. World cricket almost said, oh, New Zealand. Good on them. Good on the New Zealanders. And no, 100%. I agree with what you're saying in that Trent Bolt doesn't get enough recognition because for the past 10 years, he has been consistently one of the best bowlers in the world. It'll be a shame when we lose the likes of Southee, Bolt and Wagner because they're only probably a few years away from their careers coming to a close.
Yeah, special shout out to Wagner as well, who took a double wicket maiden with his first over of the series. Pretty remarkable. Jamie O'Noverton. 97 on test debut batting at number 80. Would have been the first Englishman to score a century on test debut batting in that position. It did look like batting got a lot easier once the ball got older, but that was still some innings, Nick, wasn't it?
Oh, I got some flashbacks to Ashton Agar, actually, a bit watching this. Obviously, the similarity is obvious. A debutante in a high-profile test match, coming in the second innings and scoring runs with a high-order batter. In that case, was Phil Hughes, and he batted with Johnny Bairstow, putting on, geez, about 250 or so. It was just an entertaining knock, a very patient knock. He does have a first-class century. He isn't a nobody with the bat, but for him to score a test century debut would have been so beautiful. I think I would have loved for him to just get that 100 and then be dismissed, whereas you yourself were saying, oh, there's something quite a bit of schadenfreude about an Englishman not quite getting to his century.
I think that's just the Australian coming out with me. Look, I love, especially a test debutant, you want them to do well. You always want them to succeed at that level. But it's just the fact that they're English that kind of pushes me over the edge of going, oh, 97, that's quite sweet as well, kind of statistically. But the other bit, Ben Fokes, obviously was pulled out for one day of the game. Johnny Bairstow was back in with the gloves after his innings due to back soreness. And then it's turned out that he's tested positive to COVID and he's out of the game and Sam Billings gets another test cap. Can you quite make sense of this?
I'll let the conspiracy theories begin. A sore back suddenly turns into COVID. Oh, what a surprise. But shout out to Sam Billings. He had to do a big drive yesterday morning. Arrived at the venue smiling, absolutely beaming. He's got another chance at test cricket. And I'm not sure if you saw last night, but he took quite a hilarious catch off Jack Leach's bowling. It kind of spilled between his legs and he kind of had to awkwardly, with his thighs together, pluck it from between his thighs. And it counted, obviously. I think he tweeted today, it's in the book. It's a test catch, despite how ugly it looked. Just a bizarre test career for him. He was rushed into the Ashes side ahead of Hobart after a few injuries. And once again, he's had to frantically make his way to Headingley for a test match. So hopefully next time he plays for England, he at least knows beforehand, at least has a couple of days notice.
Well, it was really interesting. During the Ashes, he had to do that drive down from Queensland to join the test squad as well. So he's getting used to some last minute packing at the moment there. Poor Sam Billings. But another one, I think Fokes has been good, but Billings is also a good keeper, so it'll be interesting to see what they do there into the future. So we're kind of assuming it'll be a 3-0 series win for England, and it kind of helps their position in the Test Championship quite a bit. They could almost jump New Zealand at the moment in terms of percentages. They've both got pretty low spots at the moment. Australia up the top with 75% win, and South Africa currently sitting in second with 71% win. So this series against Sri Lanka will be very important for the Aussies. They'll they just need to avoid some big series losses, and they should almost be able to kind of wrap up that place in the World Test Championship final, because the chasing pack, sort of India, who are in third, are in 58% wins. So there's quite a big gap there at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of happens going forward there. Yeah, obviously another little bit of test cricket that is going on. Bangladesh are currently taking on the Windies in the second test, and it's looking like Windies will go close to an innings victory there after posting 408, Bangladesh 234, and then 6 for 132 at stumps. So they still need 42 runs to even make with the West Indies bat again. So, yeah, we'll watch that one with anticipation as well, because everything has an influence on the World Test Championship at the moment. Nick, let's talk Big Bash. We spoke about it last episode. We spoke about the introduction of the international player draft that had been rumoured. We saw that finally come to fruition last week with lots kind of said about it. The logistics kind of outlaid more that there would be retention. Each team would get a retention pick to bring back a player that was already in their squad last season, that it'll be a draft system where the Renegades, Heat or Stars will get one of the first picks, and that'll be weighted in terms of their finishing position last year. I mean, what do you make of the system? I mean, it's good. It's going in the right direction, but I just don't know if it'll achieve the purpose that it set out to.
Yeah, I reflect on, it was actually yourself and I were at the SCG Media Box about 4 or 5 months ago, and we were frantically refreshing our Twitter streams while the IPL auction was happening. And that sense of excitement in the box and on social media and among the fans of which players are going where, who's been signed by what club, what franchise. And at the least, I hope that same kind of sense of excitement happens when this BBL draft happens, because hopefully fans are saying, oh, where's Rashid Khan going to be next year? Where is Joss Butler going to be? If at the very least it sparks a bit of excitement among fans ahead of the series, then I think it's achieved its purpose. It's a little bit gimmicky. It's a little bit, I wouldn't say unnecessary, but anything to get the fans engaged I think is worthwhile. And we'll have to wait and see what it actually looks like. It's meant to happen sometime over the next month or so. But who knows? It could be exciting. It could be a really good addition to the competition.
I just think they're going to really, they have to rely on the players who opt to put their name in this draft. And I think that's the concern, that what we've seen in most recent seasons with the Big Bash is that, excuse me, the highest profile international players haven't really come down to play. And that's been a money thing, yes. And this rectifies that, which I think is important. But also, as we know, there are new competitions coming, which are likely going to be offering more money. And Cricket Australia has kind of said, look, you can come down for 4 weeks, make the money, and bugger off to the UAE or South Africa before finals. We're happy with that. And I just think that the BBL shouldn't be happy with that, that if they're getting these players here, that they should want them to be here for the whole tournament. And it comes to an interesting point that has been raised over the last couple of days about the BBL looking to privatise, and to get more money into the game, we need to privatise. And Usman Khawaja was asked about this at a press conference ahead of the Sri Lanka test, and said that he was concerned that the BBL could be left behind. Here are some of his quotes. And I personally think that the BBL, if it wants to grow and be fair dinkum, and you know when someone says fair dinkum, they're being serious, fair dinkum about it, we do need to think about privatising it. It has been set up as a really good tournament, but I generally think that's the next evolution. I've had chats with Nick Hockley about this. I chatted to him about it 2 weeks ago, and I think he's on a very similar page. At some stage, Cricket Australia's got to let go of the reins a little bit. If that means doing it over a five-year plan, the ball's got to start rolling sooner rather than later. Because if we're not careful, we're going to be left behind, and you don't want to do that because the BBL is a great product. We've seen our colleague at News Corp, Ben Horn, kind of report that IPL teams may look to, or the owners of the IPL franchises would be keen to look at the BBL teams as a possible option to expand their sporting portfolio. When you hear privatization of the BBL, Nick, does that excite you or does it scare you?
There's something very quaint about Cricket Australia owning the competition. I mean, Cricket Australia kickstarted it 10 years ago, and they did such a fantastic job in building up to what it is. And in some respects, it would be a shame, but it probably is, admittedly, the best thing in the long term for it to be privatised. I mean, Usman Khawaja, as you said, he has a high-profile role on the ACA, and if he's saying this, then it seems pretty clear that the players must be on board with it as well. It's not going to happen this summer. As you said earlier, it might happen over the course of a few years.
I guess for me, it's twofold. And another point that Khawaja raised was that there is a concern that all this focus on getting international players in, that we're going to have these local players not having the right pathways or not being paid well enough to play in the competition. We saw Hayden Kerr join us, get sent to the Sixers as a rookie contract, one of the cheapest contracts in the competition, who became their player of the season, and that we might struggle to see players like that have as much of an influence. One thing that I want to include on that is that I really like that the Brisbane Heat, they've confirmed that their squad for BBL 12 will have two players from the local Queensland T20 competition that'll be brought up there. Look, that there may be players we've seen already in the BBL. There may be players who have played for the Heat before. There's a good chance that happens. But they're kind of going, look, we're going to keep two spots in our squad there for the people who impress in this state T20 comp. And I really like that idea of promoting the pathways a bit more, because I don't know. I just think that there's not enough almost risk and reward with the BBL at the moment. It feels very much like we've got our eight teams. It's not like other competitions around the world where there's promotion and relegation. A team like the Renegades continues to do badly. It's like, all right, well, you'll get back next year. We'll try again next year. Whereas I just feel like there needs to be a bit more cutting edge. Like we see in the IPL where teams take risks with recruitment, that teams kind of might go all in, like the Mumbai Indians, and they kind of changed their strategy and they've struggled. Whereas a team like Chennai kind of has done a lot of the same things, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And I don't know, it just feels like the BBL has plateaued a lot. And I think it's a great sign that Cricket Australia has recognised that something needed to change. But I think it has to be the first of many steps, because Uzi's right. This competition is a great competition. It's got a great platform. But because we kind of just sat on our laurels and gone, okay, the BBL, it's a good product, other products have become better. And we're still the BBL. And I really hope that this is just the first of many steps to kind of keep this product growing, because it is a fantastic product and it is well-loved. Kids love it. Adults, for the most part, love it. But the last couple of seasons have not been right. And I think everyone can kind of agree with that.
Yeah, this almost goes against what I said earlier, but gimmicks just won't work anymore. I mean, they brought in the X Factor to try and revitalize the competition, and as we know, that just flopped pretty miserably. If the X Factor is again in this upcoming summer, that'll be pretty disappointing. I do pray for the future of the BBL, and hopefully it's a enthralling summer of cricket ahead.
For me, three things. Great players. You need short games. We don't need any of that IPL 4-hour long T20 game stuff with tactical timeouts. Get through the games quickly. Shorter season. I think they're the three things that they need to be worked on. And they don't necessarily have to be all at the one time. We can work on it throughout the seasons, but everything has to be looking towards those couple of things. Last little bit of BBL news that we need to touch on. JPATS, Jimmy Pattinson, will not be playing for the Renegades this season. Can you talk us through a little bit about what happened there, Nick?
Yeah, essentially, obviously, James Pattinson retired from international cricket last summer. So he subsequently lost his international contract. But although he will still be playing Shield cricket for Victoria, he obviously is prioritising his family. He's made that decision relatively early on at age 31. And he did post to Instagram earlier this week, essentially saying, I just can't be doing the BBL. I need to spend some time with my family. He apologised to the fan base. I think he still had 1 year remaining on his contract with the Renegades, so he obviously won't be fulfilling that. And look, it's great for him, but it's a massive loss for the competition. I mean, not only an international quality player, but a really exciting, fast, quick, who has a knack of steaming in with the new white ball and wrecking havoc. So, yeah, a big shame, but I mean, hats off to him for making this decision. I mean, a lot of players don't. Frankly, just don't prioritise their family, and some players come out to say they really regret it. So, no, all the best to him.
Absolutely, all the best. The last thing that we want to touch on before wrapping up this week's episode is that we've got women's test cricket back Starting tonight, as we record this, England are taking on South Africa. South Africa will be playing their first test match since 2014, which is really exciting to see. And I think it's going to be a good match in Taunton. There will be no Catherine Brunt for England, Nick, though. That is that's big news.
Yeah, she's retired from the longest format of the game. She will continue playing ODI and T20 international cricket, which is great, obviously, ahead of next year's T20 World Cup for England. But no, like a massive loss, because she is the highest wicket taker in women's test cricket this century. 50 scalps, I think it was.
Mm.
This does feel like a changing of the guard for England. A few young pace bowlers coming through, and it'll be similar to Australia, actually. We've seen when Australia plays test cricket over the past couple of years, a lot of young guns coming through, 17, 18-year-olds. So we might see the same thing with England starting from tonight, I believe it is.
Yeah, I'm hoping Lauren Bell plays. I think she'll be a really exciting one to watch. While obviously we know what kind of Kate Cross and Sophie Eccleston can do. We saw that in the test here. South Africa, for me, the fact that we get to see Laura Vilvaart finally play test cricket, oh, I cannot wait. She scored a century in their trial game against England A. I reckon she'll open the batting. Just if there was ever a player in women's cricket right now that deserves to be playing test cricket or was perfectly suited to test cricket, it would be Phoebe Litchfield, but then right behind her, it would be Laura Vilvaart.
I think on Phoebe Litchfield very quickly, I see her as a long-term replacement for Rachel Haynes, like whenever she decides to step away from the game. So that's something to look out for. But no, 100% Laura Vilvaart. I mean, we've all become big fans of her through her feats in the WBBL. And she just seems to be made for test cricket, doesn't she? So, I mean, fingers crossed Taunton provides something a little bit more exciting than what we saw in 2019, which was quite disgusting, actually, and remains a big talking point. But no, England cricket have assured fans that this is going to be not a used pitch and it will provide a great contest between the bat and ball. And as Mel Jones pointed out on Sky Cricket last night, they are moving to the Duke ball as well, not the Kookaburra. Which I feel like should benefit the bowlers. I mean, I'm not going to pretend to know anything about the physics of the Duke and Kookaburra ball, but I feel like, yeah, hopefully see a few more wickets and not another long drawn-out draw as we've seen in pretty much every test match over the past 5-6 years.
Absolutely not. And make sure, if you've got any interest in this game, watch it, engage with it. Let's prove the comments of Greg Barclay, the ICC chair, wrong, that women's test cricket is the way to go from here, because I think there is a general agreement amongst the fans, amongst the players, that it is, and we just need to make sure that the hierarchy get that message as well. Nick, that is where we're going to leave it for this week's episode. Anything cricket-wise you're working on at the moment?
I am on annual leave at the moment, actually. I won't go into it in detail. I was meant to go to India later this week, but my visa was repeatedly rejected, until I worked out what the problem was, but it was too late, essentially. I won't bore you with the details of that. But no, I've got about 10 days off, so I'm going to be enjoying some Australia versus Sri Lanka test matches from the comfort of home without any work obligations. But no, nothing pressing for me. What about yourself, Locke? What's happening over the next few days for you?
Yeah, a few bits and pieces. Got a few, hopefully, chats with some players. Maybe no one that's actually involved in this test match, but players in and around the squad, and hopefully some of the women's team before they head over to England for the T20 Tri-Series and the Comm Games. So, yeah, there's a bit going on at the moment, and it really feels like cricket's in a good spot at the moment. So, cannot wait to see everything that's going on at the moment. So, Nick, it has been a pleasure, as always, to chat all things cricket with you. Let's go, Glenn Maxwell. Let's go, Australia. And we'll catch you guys next week.